coming up on Boston Public Radio, the number two Republican in the House loses in Virginia. The pundits say compromise, forget about it. The Tea Party is on the rise. But was that really the message of yesterday's vote? We'll ask you. Then medical ethicist Art Kaplan on whether planting chips in the Taliban 5 passes the ethics test and whether you should ever have surgery on a Monday. Then Globe editor Brian McGrory on expansion of his newspaper and bias against black judges.
Continuing our interviews with the gubernatorial candidates, Attorney General Martha Coakley joins us. And then our highly anticipated music roundtable, the best of summer jazz, classical, a little country, and a little rock and roll. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Joining us on the phone, as he does every Wednesday, is the editor of the Boston Globe. That'd be Brian McGrory. Good afternoon, Brian.
Hello, Jim. How are you?
Great.
Hello, Brian McGrory.
Hello, Marjorie Egan. How are you?
I'm great. I'm dying to ask you about this Adrian Walker piece that you guys had on the front page of the Metro section today. I was stunned
front
by
page
this.
Of the paper.
Front page,
front page of the paper.
Front page above the fold of the whole paper.
Excuse me. I stand corrected. Not the Metro. He's the Metro columnist, but he's on the front page today. Anyway, this piece about this significant evidence of racial bias against black judges, which stunned me. Tell people about this piece.
Well, what Adrian found, what he learned was that they do these surveys every year of lawyers about judges, and that what he was able to discern is that typically black judges got the lowest rankings from lawyers, and it happened enough that it was apparently a real problem. So specialists were brought in to decipher the information, and they have looked at it hard and realized that there does, in fact, appear to be strong evidence of that black judges are held, for whatever reason, bizarre reason, in lower esteem by the lawyers who anonymously, and that's a very key point here, anonymously rank them.
And by the way, the vast majority of those lawyers, according to Adrian, are white lawyers. Why is it the anonymity, which you just focused on for a second there, Brian? Why ever anonymous in a situation like this? What, lawyers aren't going to be grown up enough to be honest if their names are going to be attached?
Well, Jim, you think it's because they don't want to criticize a judge they got a
well,
case right
they
in front got, of?
They have to grow up. I mean,
I think it's Marjorie's point. Do you want to be out there, you know, being critical of a lawyer, of a judge who you may end up going before? And it just creates an awkward situation. In fact, I mean, look, you can ask the larger question, why are lawyers being called on to rank judges? I mean, is that really who we want ranking our judges, is the lawyers who go before them?
Well, who's going to do that? I mean, one of my problems is the whole time that there is a lifetime tenure, at least till retirement age, is an issue to begin with. And can I get back to anonymity? I'm not suggesting these things be given to the judges themselves, but whatever panel does the evaluation looks at the things. If they want to call back the person who evaluated them, put your name on it, and there should be a commitment that it's not going to be disclosed to the judges about whom you're writing. What's wrong with that as a compromise?
I don't disagree with that at all. Not at all. This quickly, if you play this out, it quickly slides into an argument over whether you should have elected judges. And, you know, that's a whole different discussion. But, I think it's actually not a bad discussion to have, given, as you point out, the lifetime tenure that these judges get.
Well, you know, she's a federal judge. She's not a state judge. But Casper, the judge that was Denise Casper, that was the judge on the Whitey Bulger trial. I remember as soon as her name was announced before the trial began, right away there was all this criticism. She wasn't sophisticated enough. She hadn't been there long enough. And a black judge. And there was some good debate about whether or not she should have allowed Whitey Bulger to put in his defense about that he got immunity from the government to run around living his life of crime. But gee, to me, even though I couldn't see it, she looked like she did a pretty good job at that trial, and that was a tough trial.
She did a fantastic job. I mean, it was a really sprawling, unwieldy trial filled with difficult characters, and she kept it moving along. She, you know, what do you and I know about Jim? Don't you have a law degree?
I have a law degree, so yeah,
you know,
I do.
Marjorie,
thank
what do you
Brian.
And I know about her decisions up there? But she seemed in full control all of the time, an authoritative figure from the bench. Kevin Cullen at the time wrote an utterly beautiful column about the this is the right use of the word irony, but the irony of a bigot like Whitey Bulger having to appear before a black
woman.
Okay,
hold on for 1 second. I got to just point out I beat him to it.
You did?
I wrote it first.
Did you really?
Yes, I
all
did,
right.
But I loved it. Because such a misogynist and such a guy that couldn't stand black people, you're right. It was great. But that's okay. Kevin,
can we get back to Walker
too?
Just for 1 second? One thing I'm not sure was 100% clear here is the reports that Adrian got a hold of concluded, at least two out of the three, this is not about underperforming black judges, but that racial bias was the motivation of these evaluators. That we should make clear. And by the way, we have the governor in tomorrow, and I think my sense is that it'd be interesting to get his two cents on what is a pretty frightening report in 2014.
And yeah, but Jim, I'd actually take a little bit of exception to that.
Sure.
I don't think that was unclear in the Adrian Walker column.
Unclear in our discussion. I don't think it was unclear at all. He made the point quite powerfully. I'm not sure we did. Let's move on to something else that was in your paper today, though, Brian. The headline is this, is former top aide O'Brien, meaning the former head of the probation department, testifies. The latest sordid details that come out yesterday is about this unholy alliance between John O'Brien, who's the defendant, one of the defendants in this case, former Speaker Tom Finneran, to wrest the hiring decisions away from state judges and give it to the commissioner here. Putting aside the content for a second, my fear, and Marjorie and I discuss this a lot, is anybody paying attention to this trial? Again, not on television because it's in a federal courtroom. I think it goes to the core of the worst of what Beacon Hill is. Is anybody paying attention to this thing?
Well, it's a good question. I think, yes, people on Beacon Hill are. People in the political community are. They aren't just paying attention. They're obsessed by it. They're wondering when their names are going to come up, how they're going to come up, how they're going to appear, what friends are saying, what. They are following this thing minute by minute. The key question here, and I think it's what you're getting to, is the general public involved in this trial in a way that perhaps they should be? And I don't know about that. I'm not sure. I mean, we're continuing to play the stories with relative prominence every day. We're covering it every day with one of our best reporters, Milton Valencia. And we think it's important. We think it gets to very, very important issues, and we think ultimately the verdict is going to be key for many, many years to come on how Beacon Hill goes about doing some of its core jobs. So,
yeah, but let me disagree with you here. My sense is I agree that people on Beacon Hill are quaking, but if they conclude what I've concluded is the vast majority of the public is not paying attention, then the quaking ends when the trial ends. And this gets back to the thing you and Marjorie and I have discussed ad nauseum. If there was a camera in this courtroom and we saw former State Senator Jack Hart a week or so ago testifying,
that was disgraceful.
I don't remember. I don't know if I appointed this one. I don't know who he is. How many thousands? Like Maria Lopez, remember her, the judge?
Oh, yeah.
Who ended up, because it was, I think Channel 5 had the video, it was on.
Well, some people thought that was gender bias in
well,
that case.
But if we had the Jack Hart testimony or the testimony of other legislators at this trial on television ad nauseum, then things would change, no?
I agree with that. It's just a peripheral point. I mean, Jack Hart's a great guy, we all know that.
But, yeah, he is.
That was just a stunning performance that happened to occur on the same day that the former head of the Bank of Ireland was in a different courtroom claiming that he couldn't remember anything about how he was squandering money. It was just the case of collective amnesia among influential people was amazing that day. I was dying for a columnist to grab onto that and tell us what we were supposed to think. I agree. Look, if this was on TV, it would be interesting. But part of the problem, Jim, is it's almost like part of the problem with Major League Baseball these days. The trial's going on too long. You can't be gripped by every single day, every single mid-level aide who goes there. There are some people who are more important than others who are appearing on the stands. There are some people who are more interesting than others. And, you know, the reality is that it's not interesting day in, day out.
Okay, well, I have to disagree with you, and I'll tell you why. Last week we learned, and boy, all of us have been waiting for this, Terry Murray, the Senate president, when she retires, she's writing a book. And who hasn't been waiting for a book from Terry Murray? Well, do you think if we had seen on television a week or two before that she recommended passionately a family friend's son who was, quote, woefully underqualified, according to the judges who evaluated him, and was a heroin addict who was fired 2 years later for heroin possession, you think she would have been standing up touting in front of the press saying, by the way, I know you're all waiting for my book about what it's like to be a woman Senate president on Beacon Hill? Never, never.
No, you're right, but you had to be more specific. Which underqualified heroin addict was...
Brian, you have to understand the real problem here. I believe Terry Murray has refused to be interviewed on Jim's
that is
show,
correct.
Broadside,
that
the news with Jim Brody.
So she ever been on our radio show with you, Marjorie?
No, she's actually returned my phone call, so Jim, so I'm ahead of you on that one.
Okay, fine.
It's funny with her. I once had a relatively delightful lunch up on Beacon Hill with her, and then I don't think she's returned a call to the Globe since.
But, you know what I did love about Terry Murray, as long as we're on the subject? She was incensed. Remember when everybody turned to Deval Patrick and then Barack Obama and the whole race, she said she was sick of licking envelopes for like 40 years for all these guy candidates. She wanted some women to win. So I did like it when she kind of blew a gasket over that one.
Hey, Brian, you have a new political section on Friday. And the good news for people like me who are obsessed with politics is it's exactly what we're looking for. But it means expansion in an era of contraction, the newspaper business. Are you convinced, and it really was terrific, it's got from, I mean, it's just terrific. It's a special new Friday thing, new polling data every week, columns, analysis, all this sort of great little graphics. Are you convinced real people are into this, or is this just an insider kind of deal?
Well, I appreciate you bringing it up, and I appreciate that question. Yeah, the key for us, Jim, and it's a legitimate issue to raise. It's something that's on our minds all the time. The key for us is to make this appeal to real people. And it can't be a stodgy, buttoned-up section that is devoted to the minutiae of
of the probation trial.
I was actually just thinking of that, and I had to say no. No, this has to be an accessible section that is actually helping to advance a civic discussion here. The way I look at it is, on the one turn, it has to have depth and heft. But on the other hand, it also has to have some breeze to it too. It has to be an enjoyable read, and we think we've added a lot of elements that will help that along. We've got a lot of data in it that is going to reflect a weekly poll that we're doing, both on the horse races in the state in terms of the campaigns, but also the issues that really do affect people's everyday lives. So we're going to be doing that every week. It's a rolling poll. We will never be surprised by the Eric Cantor-like defeat in Virginia, because we are going to be polling very closely week by week by week. Nobody else in the country is doing that like we're doing it. We've hired an outfit out of Cambridge that is interpreting social media for us and telling us what the trends are, what the conversations are, who the influencers are. So we're going to tap deeply into that. We'll have a, for lack of a better way of putting it, political gossip column, who's coming and
love
going
that.
On Beacon Hill, who's up and down, who's doing what to whom. We aim to make this an enjoyable section to read. But when you're done with it, you say, you know what, that was a good half hour spent.
You know what I wonder about, Brian, with everything that's happening in newspapers and changing in digital and people reading online, et cetera? It was always kind of the conventional wisdom, you know, that when sports teams, whether it was the Patriots or the Red Sox or in the World Series or the Super Bowl or something, this was huge for newspaper print sales. And I wonder whether when the Red Sox are struggling, does it matter? Is the converse true? Does it hurt? And especially now that so many people are reading the Globe online and newspapers online in general, or is it just a wash?
I don't think it when teams are doing poorly, it doesn't hurt what we do. It doesn't hurt what we sell. It doesn't hurt the number of page views we get online. But when teams are doing well, when the Patriots and the Red Sox and the Bruins are in the playoffs, we do see a surge of interest online. When they win, when they lose, the analysis of it, we see a major traffic coming to us. I'm not sure if a routine, playoff series affects print sales. I do know that when they win a championship, it does.
Yeah.
But we see it online to the good. When they're not doing well, it's not like we see a precipitous drop-off. We get the benefit, but we don't get hurt much when they're not doing well.
Yeah, speaking of sports, here's my prediction. You know, I'm a student of both the Globe and its editor, Brian McGorry. Here's my prediction for tomorrow. My prediction is there will be a special section on the World Cup in the Globe tomorrow. Am I right?
Jim,
what's that?
I mean,
I am, aren't I?
No, we chat every morning on our respective drives into work about whether Croatia is going to defeat Bolivia in next week's match, and I can't get enough of it. So Fortunately, I have an owner over here now, an owner of the Globe who does, in fact, own a soccer team.
Oh, that's right. Liverpool or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
So I'm running around here in those high knee socks and...
I'm serious.
Really?
Aren't you doing aren't you doing some big deal tomorrow? I'm serious about this. Tomorrow, doesn't the World Cup start tomorrow?
Yeah,
don't
we have
ask
the World
me.
Cup down at where is it? Schaefer Stadium or whatever that Gillette Stadium. We've got the World Cup is down there, right?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Close
we
enough.
Are. We
I guess
are,
there's no special section.
We are all excited. Let me just guarantee that.
Okay. Hey, I just have one quick thing, Brian, before you go. I didn't realize that you and Jim spoke every morning.
Just about soccer.
You didn't speak this morning because Jim has been devastated. He's brokenhearted and crushed because apparently he
Not
texted
crushed.
You. Well, you are, Jim. Let's be honest here. He texted you about it. You did a very nice little story in the business section of the Globe yesterday about getting an extra hour here at GBH. Mm-hmm. That was wonderful. But it didn't make Jim happy, and he wants to know why you didn't text him back about his problem.
Do you want to know what his complaint was?
Yes, we do.
First of all, the deal margin I made that she would not bring this up on the air, but there's nothing I can do about it now. So go right ahead. Go ahead.
Only Jim Browdy could send me a text at like 5 a.m. Before we had our soccer discussion, complaining of the number of chins it appears that he had in the photo of the business section.
That is correct.
I will say congratulations to you guys for the third hour of the show. It's going to be a gift to Boston.
Thank you very much.
But he thought you were going to take care of him on the chin front, Brian, and you let him down.
Yeah, well, here's the funny part, Marjorie. I actually did. You should have seen the photo I pulled out. So,
Jim
is entirely unappreciative of my efforts over here.
Okay.
On that note,
you happy now, Jim?
No, I'm actually not. But thank you. And thank you, Brian McGrory. It's good to talk to you. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for calling. As always, Brian McGrory is the editor of the Boston Globe, and we talk to him every Wednesday. Okay, coming up, the number two Republican in the House, the guy a lot of us expected to succeed, John Boehner, he got trounced by a Tea Party guy. The conventional wisdom is immigration reform is dead, the Tea Party's on the way back, and the supposed reemergence of the more moderate establishment GOP, forget about it. Is that conventional wisdom correct or not? We're going to debate that with you guys coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
This is what listener-supported radio sounds like.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're going to invite you into the conversation.
In fact, 7 out of every $10 spent on daily operations here at WGBH comes from listeners.
I'll tell you, I'm in a particularly good mood today, Marjorie.
I can't really handle it myself.
89.7 WGBH, your home for public radio.
WGBH Radio exists thanks to you and Babson College, committed to transforming the students of today into the entrepreneurial leaders of tomorrow with an MBA program in Boston and Wellesley. You can find more information online at babson.edu. And Skinner, presenting the Andrew Shaker Collection at auction, Sunday, June 15th at the Skinner Marlborough Gallery. The auction includes Shaker furniture and rare artifacts. More information at skinnerinc.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Earthquake. Apocalyptic moment. Shocker. Explosion. That's how the media are describing Eric Cantor's big loss in last night's GOP primary in Virginia. But the media could turn those words on themselves. Virtually none of them saw this upset coming. And their postmortem may be far from a real forensic look at how and why Cantor lost, at least according to me. Today, the conventional wisdom is that Cantor lost to David Brett, and Brett's a Tea Party-backed economics professor down there, because Cantor was soft on immigration. So now everyone is saying immigration reform is even deader than it was before. In fact, any compromise is doomed. But what about the other themes that people are not talking about? Could this also be a referendum on big money? Cantor had it. Brett did not. Then there's the adage, all politics is local, Marjorie. Was that in play? Do political wins boil down to retail politics? Some think we saw that in the Scott Brown-Martha Coakley race of a couple of years ago. So the question's for you at 877-301-8970. What was the real message of yesterday's vote in Virginia and some other places too? And yourself. How do you vote and why do you vote? Is it on the issues or is it based upon the attention that your elected officials or a challenger gives to you as a voter? 877-301-8970. Just so you know, and if you were asleep, that I'm not making this up, here's a fair montage of TV pundits talking about how much of a game changer Bratt's win allegedly is.
No one saw it coming, the defeat of House Majority Leader Eric Cantor by an ultra-long-shot Tea Party candidate.
People are yearning for a leader. They do not like the status quo, whether it's defended by Republicans or Democrats.
This is a political earthquake.
This gives a new energy, I think, to the Tea Party anti-Washington, anti-Wall Street signal to the Republican Party.
This is a huge blow, no question about it.
Stunning, right? Bratt's victory was completely unexpected.
Now, the only part of that, Marjorie, that I think is totally true was completely unexpected by virtually everybody. But I have to say, sitting there last night watching this, I'm saying this is the laziest bunch of reporters who basically want the storyline to be that it's an explosion, it's an earthquake, when in fact, I'll make the case to you right now that it's nothing of the sort. The conventional wisdom, as I said a minute ago, is he was soft on immigration, even though he wasn't. And as a result, Bratt was able to beat him. Well, do you know who really is, quote, soft on immigration, who was part of the Gang of Eight, who wants comprehensive immigration reform? Lindsey Graham, Republican senator from South Carolina. He faced Tea Party challengers last night in South Carolina. You know what he did? He beat them all. And you know what the basic, let me finish my thought here. The basic message, at least in my estimation, of yesterday, is this was not about a challenge from the right. It was about a challenge to a guy who spends $20,000 and $30,000 for steak dinners for himself and supporters in Washington, D.C., and ignored his home district. What did everybody say about Lindsey Graham? The reason they believed Lindsey Graham was going to survive the Tea Party challenge last night from multiple candidates is because he was in his district all the time showing people that they were his first concern, not the elite of Washington.
No, he did.
That's not the message of Cantor's defeat.
He ran a great campaign, but I think when there's seven people running against you and the vote is split,
they didn't
seven
get 50% between them, but between all seven of them.
But it's still significant. It's still significant that he had all those people running against him. Bill, you'd be happy to know our first email, though he agrees with you. He says the Cantor election saw less than 45,000 votes cast. There were more people on my Orange Line train this morning. There's no mandate on anything. That's from Bill. So he's with you.
I hope you're right.
But this made me very unhappy. And the reason it made me unhappy is because it does. You can count this seven ways to Sunday. This does give a boost to the Tea Party. And I'm not happy with the Tea Party because I would like to see some agreement on things like comprehension, immigration reform. This does make, I think, Republicans that are worried about a Tea Party challenge a little bit more worried.
Only if you buy the mindless line about why Eric Cantor lost last. Did you see John King's analysis, our friend from CNN? Eric Cantor got almost 9,000 fewer votes yesterday than he did 2 years ago. You know what that message is? He didn't work his own base. If just the people who had supported Cantor supported him again last night, he would have won the primary and we wouldn't even be talking about this.
Now listen, I hope you're right. I also think that this is that the conventional wisdom that you've criticized as being ridiculous has some merit to it when they talk about, you know, what were we talking about 2 weeks ago? We were talking about the Tea Party on the wane. We were talking about the hopefulness among moderate Republicans, so-called establishment Republicans, that they were on the upswing and that they would do better in 2016 and do better in the midterm. So I don't know. This would make me very nervous if I had a Tea Party opponent. It absolutely would. And then you have people, the power of the media. We've got a clip here from Laura Ingraham. She's a radio talk show host, very, very conservative. She apparently not only talked about him nonstop in her syndicated radio show, which is all over the country.
Anti-Cantor.
Yes, she was very anti-Cantor. She even went and stumped for him. Here she is at the Dominion Club in Virginia on behalf of this guy, Dave Bratt. You must get some kidding about being named Dave Bratt. But anyway, here he is.
He doesn't have to do what he's doing right now. He has a great life as a university professor at a wonderful school, Randolph-Macon. And he has a beautiful family. He wants to spend time with them. And he decided, like so many of our great leaders in the past, to give up their very comfortable existence, at least for a time, to try to make a difference in his country.
Our number is 877-301-8970. The conventional wisdom is that Ingram's presence also made a huge difference. Maybe it did in terms of getting out Bratt's vote, But I would argue it had nothing to do with him, with Eric Cantor not spending enough attention on getting out his own vote. And that's the message of yesterday. If one is sloppy and lazy, and by the way, the media wants the storyline. They want the storyline because it's good for eyeballs and readers and viewers and listeners that this is the rise of the Tea Party again. It is, Marjorie may be right. Every Republican may be scared in Washington. It may mean the end of any compromise, not that there was about to be any, but this election is not what should have caused that, because that is not, if you look at the hard numbers and look at the facts, that is not about what yesterday in Richmond, in my opinion, is about. 877-301-8970. Two questions. One, what do you think the message of yesterday was? And number two, what's the message with you? Do you vote based upon issues? Or, as we know, our own Tip O'Neill, the most famous line in American politics, is all politics local? Lindsey Graham in South Carolina got that. Eric Cantor did not.
You know, Marjorie just emailed, and if you said this, Jim, I apologize, I didn't hear it, but she was pointing out that the polls in Virginia had Cantor ahead by a mile, and they did. His pollster taking a lot of heat.
His own pollster had him up 34 points.
34 points like a week ago or something like that. So she was saying that people maybe didn't feel the need to get out and vote because they thought Cantor was going to win by so much. That's a point as well, even though this was a smaller turnout and it was the really diehards that go out for these primaries. But that's a good point.
Well, yeah, but Eric Cantor, theoretically, and by the way, his pollster is skating around saying because it's an open primary, a lot of Democrats crossed over. I don't know if that's true or not. What I do know is if you're elected by people, you have an obligation to those people, not to John Boehner, not to the Washington lobbyists. Your obligation, Republican or Democrat, is to the people back home. Those candidates who get that are generally reelected, and those candidates who don't get it, it's rare, like Eric Cantor, are sent packing.
Let's go to Scott in New Bedford. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Scott. How are you doing?
Great.
So my comment is that I believe that low voter turnout skews elections and allows minority opinions to gain power. Everyone should be required to vote, and maybe they should throw out elections if you don't get more than 50% of the people voting and do it over again.
By the way, I not only believe that there should be a threshold, which I know is not popular, but you know there was an effort in Massachusetts, a variation on your theme, that allegedly would have brought people out, where you could vote for none of the above. It was a guy on the Cape who has since died who was going to start a ballot campaign, so that if you're really disgusted with what's going on, you can vote. You just don't have to vote for any of the established candidates, and if the majority goes to none of the above, then none of the above are elected to the office. Scott, thank you.
I thought you wanted to put a mandate out that forced everyone to vote. If they didn't vote, they got fined.
Well, you know, there are a lot of
ideas.
Do you know there are a lot of? I don't actually believe in that, but you know there are a lot of countries in the world where you are fined if you don't vote, and the participation is 90%. Something between what we have, which is pathetic, and this is the solution.
Let's go to Tim from Seabrook, New Hampshire. Hi, Tim.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Jim, I agree with you 100%. All politics is local. Mr. Cantor had a 27% approval rating in his district. He's not the most personable politician in the world, and he is definitely in love with himself. He put up his time in Washington as opposed to his time in the district. And there is also a possibility in the open primary that they just had that people went to the polls that were independents and voted for the other guy just to put the kibosh to Mr. Cantor, because I'm sure that his 27% approval rating in his largely Republican district translates into a higher disapproval rating in the overall population. So,
I have to say, I don't know about the approval rating thing. It's the first time I'd heard it. But so you're saying it was more of a Cantor inattention thing, which is where I'm going, as opposed to an embrace of whatever it is that Dave Brat stands for. If that's your point, I agree with it. Tim, thanks for the call. Let me give you another good example of this, maybe the best example I can think of. Do you know how many people voted for Ted Kennedy through the years who didn't agree with Ted Kennedy's politics? Mountains of them. Because you know what every one of them would say? I had a problem with Social Security 7 years ago. I called Ted Kennedy's office. A staff person called me back in an hour and worked with me to get that. He was in, as huge as he was, that's not a pun, by the way, as big as he was nationally and internationally, Kennedy was all over his district, all over Massachusetts, all the time.
Well, you know
what
else?
That's what people want. They want to know you actually care about them.
You know what else? And I think this has a lot to do with Elizabeth Warren, our new senator, being very popular in Massachusetts. Ted Kennedy was a true believer, and I think you knew he was a true believer in what he believed in. And I think a lot of politicians are very wishy-washy. They're always hedging their bets. They're always being careful. You know, when they answer questions. Elizabeth Warren is a true believer too. I think people believe that she's really obsessed with the Harrod middle class, and Ted Kennedy was obsessed.
But do you think people in the Richmond, Virginia district think this guy, who with his boss, John Boehner, never even allowed a vote on immigration, they think he was, what, wishy-washy?
Well, I think in his case, they probably thought he was too interested in maneuvering his way into to become Boehner's replacement.
I think that very well may be
the
case.
And then there was also this great line of thinking that he was too much of a yuppie. He was a yuppie Republican. He and Paul Ryan were viewed as the young gun yuppie Republicans, and maybe they didn't like that yuppie look down there in his district.
The number is 877-301-8970. We're spending time on this because, again, I gave you words that I heard last night and this morning. Earthquake, apocalyptic moment, shocker, explosion. It changes everything. By the way, Marjorie may be right, and they may be right. It may change everything. What I'm saying is it shouldn't change everything. It shouldn't change anything except how people complain. And again,
well,
the best example.
What is Virginia overall? Do they usually vote Republican or
they
Democrat?
Have mixes.
I don't know.
They have mixes. But I mean, Richmond, this district is a primarily Republican district. The issue is not, is the Democrat going to win? I haven't read anything this morning saying the Democrat's going to beat Brad, even though no one ever heard of him prior to yesterday.
Well, let's
the
hear issue from
is
him.
The, what?
Let's hear from him.
Fine.
We've got some sound of Mr. Bratt, the university professor that walloped Eric Cantor. Let's hear Dave Bratt.
I ran on free markets. I don't know that those are right or left. I ran on rule of law, property rights. I ran on immigration. I don't think those are right and left issues. I think those are just free market constitutional issues.
And he is now the Republican nominee. And by the way, I haven't heard anything about whether or not Eric Cantor is going to do a write-in campaign. Like, what's her name? The Alaska woman, Lisa Murkowski. I haven't heard any of that. But the assumption is he's going to run against a Democrat and be a new a congressperson, be the darling of the Tea Party movement. And by the way, I'm not minimizing. When you beat a sitting number two person, many people were saying this hasn't happened before at all, ever. I'm not sure whether that political history is true. But you got to do an honest analysis of what was done. And the analysis that has been spreading all over the country, at least in my estimation, is completely misguided.
Teacher sent an email. We just played a clip of Laura Ingraham. She's the syndicated talk show host, very conservative. And Dee says, interesting. I never heard someone like Laura Ingraham or any of the other of her conservative ilk speak so glowingly about the quote-unquote professorship of President Obama or of Senator Warren as she just did of the Tea Party professorship of Mr. Bratt.
Can I tell you something I liked about what she did? I liked the fact that she actually put her money where her mouth is. If you really believe that Cantor was the Antichrist, which essentially she did, and that Bratt was the now there is somebody who supported him on the merits. It was not because Cantor
wasn't.
Oh yeah,
she's a true believer too.
But
she's
if you're a true believer, then do all you can, and she did it. Let's go to Providence, Rhode Island. Jane is on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hi there, Jane.
Hello, Jim and Marjorie. This is the second time I have ever placed a call to public radio.
Oof.
That was also to you guys, but
thanks.
I am moved to speak about this Eric Cantor debacle.
Please.
I agree with Jim. I really think it's the GOTV situation. They were complacent and they didn't do much. But the question that I have is, do you think that this will be really good for us Democrats in the House because the majority of people really don't know this wonderful professor? I mean, I say wonderful. I'm sure he's not wonderful. And now they'll vote Democratic.
By the way, let me just give you two. In Richmond, I have no idea. I don't know anything about the district. But GOTV, which Jane references, Get Out the Vote, and I agree with her. There are two schools of thought about whether or not this is good for the Democrats in general. A lot of the pundits were saying last night that the Obama team was celebrating because they're able to say in the midterm elections, and Jane, thanks for your call, that the Tea Party is taking over the Republican Party. So that's the good news for Democrats. The bad news is Marjorie is right. On the in terms of outcome, even though I think the analysis is wrong about why Cantor lost, it is true that the impact is probably going to be exactly what she said, which is even less compromise than currently exists, because there are a lot of scared members of Congress, whether they should be or not. And so if Democrats and Barack Obama actually want to achieve something in the remaining few months of this session or the final 2.5 years of his term, I would argue that it's sadly pretty badly for anything getting
think,
done.
Like I said, it's going to inspire other Tea Party challenges. I mean, you see this, and you see the guys didn't have any money and came out of, I mean, didn't come out of nowhere.
But they won nothing, except in Texas. But they won nothing this round.
I know, but you could look at this as there was a reversal of the trend here, and I think that's inspiring to people.
And by the way, Marjorie makes
a very good
point.
I think Mark Fisher could prevail here in Massachusetts over Charlie Baker. What do you think?
Well, he's got $35,000 in the bank. Talking about what a different – I think I read yesterday that Charlie Baker's got close to $1 million in the bank. Mm-hmm. Fisher, who was in the news nonstop when he was trying to get on the ballot. Have you heard one word out of Mark Fisher since he's qualified for the ballot?
And it just makes you think how Massachusetts we're a little different politically than a lot of the country, are we not?
Well, no, wait. So is the rest of – let me repeat. Virtually every Tea Party challenge lost in the most recent round of primaries except in Texas and now – in Richmond, Virginia. Marjorie made a very good point a couple of seconds ago in terms of money. You may have heard this or not. Cantor had about $5 million in the bank. He spent something like $1.5 million on TV and direct mailing. And if I'm correct, Bratt himself had only, what, a couple $100,000, I think.
Yeah, not very much money. Let's be clear about that. So the money guy, for change, didn't win for change. Let's go to Carl in Pomfret, Connecticut. Hi, Carl.
Hello, Carl.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
This is the first time that I have ever called in.
Wow. Wow. Thank you for calling.
Whoops. Your first call and you just faded out. Carl, you still there? Oh, that's horrible. Carl, we're not going to... Oh, he's gone. How sad that is.
Oh, no.
Carl, do it again. Call quickly before the lines fill up. Let's go to Steve in Freetown. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Steve.
Hey, good afternoon, Marjorie and Jim.
Hi.
Listen, I have to tell you, I'm going to disagree with you, Marjorie, and I'm going to do this very respectfully.
Oh, good.
I'm a conservative Republican.
Yeah.
I'm a conservative Republican. I agree with a lot of what the Tea Party has to say. Never liked Eric Cantor. Don't get yourself all wound up, because this had absolutely zero to do with the Tea Party taking over, especially in that district. If you sit back and actually looked at some of the numbers, and I had a friend of mine who's down here. I'm a former state committee man here in Massachusetts. Set me up some of the numbers. He was in the district 3 times in the last 4 months.
Is that why you didn't like him, Steve? What? Tell me why you didn't like Cantor.
I didn't like Cantor 4 years ago because, you know what, I have to tell you, I lean libertarian.
Yep.
I am not a big business guy.
Yep.
I have a real problem with my Republican Party where they seem to be leaning more towards big business and a lot less towards me. The guy who's earning, whose family's earning between $125,000 and $200,000 a year, putting my kid through college and starving, and they're sitting there every week asking me for my money.
So wait a second. Steve, let me be clear. So you feel that the Cantors of the world, and Cantor in particular, have sort of become part of the Washington political elite that they love to hate. Is that where you're going? Is that where you're coming from here?
Absolutely. I have to tell you, Jim, I lean more libertarian because of that. I've only read a little bit on this gentleman, but the one thing that I will tell you, a friend of mine in the RNC did text me and say, this guy was hungry. This guy was there every day. He had a very large group of people who were Tea Partiers, and let's face it, whether the Republican Party likes to hear this or not, the Tea Partiers are very focused. They're very driven because they're the people who sit and do the get the signatures. Whether we want to hear, establishment, people who back establishment.
Yeah, but I got to cut you off, Steve. Let me just say, as enthusiastic and committed as the Tea Party supporters of Dave Bratt were, let me repeat, if Eric Cantor had just gotten the exact same people to vote for him yesterday who did 2 years ago, he would have had 9,000 more votes, and he would have been renominated by the Republican Party. So I'm not saying there was not enthusiasm on the Bratt side. He didn't get that many votes either. There was low turnout, low interest in this race, and essentially Cantor blew it because he cared more about steak dinners in Washington for $20,000 than he did about the people back home.
Right, but that's what I'm trying to say, Jim. That's what people like Cantor have become. This guy was hungry, and he had a good group of people who were willing to get out there and beat feet and knock on doors. And I have to tell you, sometimes that's all it takes. I was happy to see this guy win. I don't know if I agree with him, but I have to tell you, I think that losing Eric Cantor is not that big a deal to the Republican Party.
Got it.
And
Steve,
you know what I mean?
Let me ask you one last quick thing, because we have a Tea Party candidate in Massachusetts, Mark Fisher. What do you think of him?
I think he's useless. This whole mess that I watched on Red Mat.
Oh no!
I just wish he would go away. And I have to tell you, I don't have a lot in common with Charlie Baker, but someone like Mr. Fisher to me is just bad for the party.
Well, Steve, the problem with you is you don't have strong opinions. But thanks for your
call. That
was
a great call, Steve, from Freetown, which is a beautiful, very pretty place. Do we have time for one more call?
Squeeze
here?
In one more really quick.
Dan
one.
In Mashpee. Hi, Dan.
Hello, Dan.
You there?
Eloquent, Dan. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Bob in Arlington really quickly. Hi, Bob. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Go.
Hi, good morning. How are you today?
We're
very well, thank you.
Thank you.
First of all, congratulations on your extra hour.
Thank you.
I'm looking so forward to it.
Oh, thank you, Bob, very much.
There is no better chemistry in talk radio than I listen to when I hear the two of you talking.
You're a sweet man. Thank you, Bob.
Absolutely. Jim, I would not worry about the 33 chins in the picture in the Globe.
Excuse me, it was three, not 33, Bob, but thank you very
three,
much.
33, give or take, you know. Okay.
Yeah.
I think your biggest concern should be, Jim, that by the time you get to the Whole Foods market for the hot lunch, there's going to be slim picking. Very slim picking.
Is this your Eric Cantor comment, Bob, or no?
No, that's politics.
Okay, Bob, thank you for your call, and thank you for your kind words.
I was like, no, he's right. Jim is right. There weren't 33 chins. I think there were seven.
No, there were three.
We counted them.
There were three. I counted every one.
Okay, up next, we are continuing our conversations with the candidates for governor in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. We are going to be joined next by the Attorney General of the Commonwealth, Martha Coakley.
Before this job, I was the environment reporter at the Boston Globe for 13 years.
Investigative reporter Beth Daly.
I know the environment very well in New England, the nation, and internationally. And I want to bring more nuance, more in-depth reporting, and more investigative reporting to the environment beat. It's one of the most important subjects of our lifetimes today.
The New England Center for Investigative Reporting, now a partner with WGBH News.
Support for WGBH comes from you and the communities of Orchard Cove and Newbridge on the Charles, offering you the information you and your parents need to make the right decision about senior living. You can check out the guide at hslindependentliving.org. And American Experience, inviting you to a free preview of Freedom Summer, the latest civil rights story from Stanley Nelson, Monday, June 23rd at Dorchester Strand Theater, presented by WGBH and the City of Boston, wgbh.org/events.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marg Regan. Secretary of State John Kerry, as you know, has defended the Bergdahl prisoner exchange, and he's been unequivocal when discussing the administration's commitment to monitoring the five Taliban operatives who were released from Gitmo. Don't worry about them in Doha, that's what Kerry said. So hypothetically, what if Kerry's confidence is rooted in the fact that the Taliban members have been chipped? Let's assume for a moment that they've had surveillance chips surgically implanted in them. You know, the kind of monitoring chips that many of your pets have. Would that be ethical? In the name of national security, would it be ethical to turn these guys, essentially, unbeknownst to them, into spies? Joining us to take on this ethical riddle, among others, is Art Kaplan. Art is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He also co-edited the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Hello there, Art.
I'm listening to you through a chip in my head right now.
I have news for you. If my mother, I'm the only child of a single mother, if she could have chipped me when I left the house when I was a kid, she would have, believe me.
Well, you wrote
Me too.
You wrote a great piece about this, Art, and let me preface this by saying I'm hoping these five people are chipped, just like my dog, Harry the Pea, best dog from sea to sea. But there are, as you point out in your terrific piece, there are some ethical issues here for physicians. What are they?
Well, let me make a little distinction. Your pet has a chip that would let us know it was your pet were we to find him. So he
Correct.
Has an ID chip.
Yes.
What I'm talking about is a GPS chip. So think cell phone when you want to get map directions. It knows exactly where you are. Think carjacking. When someone steals your car, we have different GPS systems to find it. So could you, and I'm not saying anybody did, but when listening to Kerry say, don't worry about these guys, it should be possible to use a GPS-type chip, surgically implant it, and I think get a power source in there, too, because that's the biggest hurdle is having some batteries so you don't have to have the juice run out on the thing. And you'd know exactly where these guys were. You'd know if they stayed in Qatar or went on to back to Afghanistan and hitched themselves up to their old friends and so forth. So ethically, if that technology's there, and I'm pretty sure it is, although that's just me speculating, would it be ethical for a doctor to put in something surreptitiously to do surgery without your consent or permission? Would it be right to do it to someone if you then kind of turn them into a target? You know, you'd be able to send a drone to kill them or hunt them down with special forces. You'd know where they were. And knowing that, should medicine have anything to do with this? It's sort of like, should doctors get involved with the death penalty?
So where would they put it? If I can leave from the ethics, I'm dying to know this. Where would they put this?
Now, this is a family program. Family program.
Okay, yeah.
Wait, is that the answer to the question, to make it undetectable?
Sure. You got to put it way inside there, probably somewhere in the intestinal tract, someplace maybe intramuscularly so it didn't get knocked around. You want it to stay in there. You want it to work. It's got to be waterproof. And I should add, you know, you don't want it easily detectable by an X-ray or something. So you're trying to make it out of materials that are a little less easy to see. It's probably not going to be corrosive metals or something. So, you know, there are locations.
Yeah. And they would be, I suppose that they, reading the press about this, they were inclined to think that maybe they had been microchipped. Can they go get an MRI or something and locate this? Or is it?
He's just saying that essentially it's on there. Your point was that there are certain elements there. I guess the materials are such that they'd be less likely to be detected, right?
Right. I mean, I think you want something that's pretty all plastic kind of thing.
So they couldn't find it.
Minimal stuff that you could see without, unless you had a super-duper scanner or something like
Art,
that.
Can we get back to the ethics just for a second? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'll do it, and then you can take them out of your mouth if you don't like. When I read your piece this morning, it sounded to me like you were getting to, yes, it's ethical, sort of through the back door. And what I mean by that is, well, listen, it's better than torturing these guys, isn't it? I mean, in terms of the ethical issue. Is that how you're doing this, that it's not quite as unethical as something else?
That's fair, very fair. So I'm thinking, all right, well, first of all, let me just go on record and say, if this technology is out there, and I'm still trying to say if, I'm not saying it is, but I can see all the parts being around. I don't think anybody listening to the show doesn't think that the CIA or the NSA or the military would use it. I mean, we can kick the ethics around, I'm going to do it, but I will tell you, boy, if they have it, they'll be using it. So I just think it's inevitable that we would see this kind of tracking technology come in. Ethically, I think it's always wrong to do things to people sneakily without permission. But if you got a court order, if you went through the proper review process, yeah, you could probably make a case for an enemy of the country, someone who is a real threat. Now, that we were joking about this before, Jim, but that isn't your teenager. They could be a real threat. You might wish to chip them surreptitiously, but that I think would be wrong. So I think you got to do it under court review, national security argument, that sort of thing.
Well,
and
as I
said in the piece,
a little
better than waterboarding them.
Yeah, but so let's take this one step further before we leave the topic, Art. We talk a lot on the show and off the show about the scourge of the helicopter parent in the 21st century. Yep. Is it unrealistic to think that the next step for nervous parents is they say when the baby pops out and post-pop out, they say, no, I'm serious. Let's put a chip in this kid so for the rest of his or her life, and obviously as a parent, they have the power to do that, unlike the issues that relate to enemy combatants or whatever. Is that that's not far-fetched at all, is it? Are there ethical issues there?
Far-fetched. I don't like it. I have Marjorie's reaction. I think it's wrong. I think you should be free to escape your parents sometimes, or to have privacy, or even to get into trouble, without being under surveillance 24/7. But you look at people; they put the monitors in the baby's room, and then there's cameras in every street corner. and pretty soon somebody wants to see your email record, and I want to have access to your Facebook account. I just think 30, 40 years from now, if that chip is around, I think they're gonna do what you just said. I don't think it's right. I think it's too intrusive on individual freedom and even individual development of your character and your self-identity. But I think it's coming. I really do.
We're talking to ethical methicist.
Ethical methicist. I love that.
Bioethicist, Art Kaplan. All right. There was this really pretty scary study about surgeons being away from the job for a day or 2 days of vacation. Tell us what the study of these 56,000 patients found.
The longer you're away, the less aptitude, skill you have. So your skills deteriorate. And we know this in a general way from doing procedures frequently. The more you do of things, generally, the better you get. One of the things I try to tell people who are trying to pick a place to get an operation or a procedure done is ask them how many they've done, how many is the doctor in particular done, because you do get more skillful. When you take a break, when you go on a long vacation, your skills start to slide. So the problem is, you don't want to be the first person back from the doctor's vacation in a serious procedure because there's a little bit more risk involved. Should that be part of informed consent? Ideally, yeah. Is it in reality? No.
You know, I have to say, I was shocked by this thing. You know, you say you get rusty after a while. They mention the people who conducted the study say that there were a variety of options, including the one that I thought was going to be the outcome, which is when you do intense work for a living, like a surgeon, and you're away a 3 day weekend.
Radio show host.
Well, by the way, we came back after a week off on Monday. We were horrible.
There you go.
But in any case,
but
I assumed if you do intense work that's really taxing and you take a 3 day weekend or a week off, not only do you not come back worse, you come back better, refreshed. So did the results surprise you at all? They surely surprised me.
They shocked me. I wasn't expecting it. Completely counterintuitive. Completely.
So you're where I am, that it should have refreshed them.
I was like, whoa, what's that? Would not have guessed that.
So what do you, so I guess two things, and you address one of them. One, why does it happen? I mean, it's hard to believe that you really lose your skills or they abate a little bit after a week off or a day off. And secondly, do you say to a doctor, by the way, I want to know if you're off a day or two, even a weekend. I don't want to see you on Monday. I want my operation on Tuesday.
I think you could ask, and I think you have every right to ask, and I think you're probably going to get a lot of dissembling lying back. That is, I think people won't really fess up to what's going on. You know, you could say, did you go out and party last night? Get enough sleep last night? Have a little fight with the partner before you came in here? You could push it. You can. I think human nature is to start say, don't worry about it. Everything's fine. I'm on top of my game, blah, blah, blah. Yes, you can ask.
Yeah, but I don't mean just ask.
Wait, answer, yes.
Well, but forget to ask for a second. One? You told us a couple of months ago to stop taking vitamins. I've saved a ton of money thanks to you. I'm serious. If I have surgery scheduled for next week.
By the way, I got to tell you one thing about vitamins.
Yeah.
There are people short on vitamin D when the doctor says, I measured you and you don't get enough
yes,
of that.
Yes, that's right.
So just for the record.
All the sunscreened people that are wearing their sunscreens 24/7. Yeah.
Okay, but getting back to the surgery thing, last thing from me, as a rule of thumb, it seems to me a normal person, listener or not, should never have surgery on a Monday. Is that's not a ridiculous position to take, is it?
It would be not ridiculous, but the shifts and the work schedules don't move like in that pattern, so you can't always be sure. You've heard me say this, and I mean it. It might not be a good idea to avoid July as your elective surgery procedure because that's when all the new residents
come in. Oh, yeah, forget that.
And it takes them about a couple of weeks to figure out what's going on. So it's going to be hard to pinpoint the date, to the day, to the hour, relative to vacation. I think this is a risk we're all going to have to live with, and that's just part of life. But the bigger patterns, you know, when do the new people come in every year, the key personnel in places like the ER? I don't know that I'd want to have my elective procedure done July 15th. I mean, just because of that big turnover.
Well, you know, Art Kaplan, the thing that you always hear is that, you know, if you have a real serious problem, you want to go to a really good hospital. I remember years ago doing a story about amniocentesis, the procedure that detects where they put a needle in the woman's amniotic fluid to detect child defects in the growing fetus.
Usually Down syndrome, something like that.
Exactly. And I remember a physician one of the big Boston hospitals, the Brigham, I think it was, saying to me, you know, you're at the Brigham in Boston. Who's up at the risk of miscarriage? That, you know, we do a million of these. Nobody's having miscarriages from these here. You go to some little podunk hospital out in Iowa, you might have a little more of a problem. The point being, better hospital, more times they do it. That's a big deal.
True, but it would be a lot better to have numbers on the particular doc. Remember, somebody's doing their first amniocentesis even at the Brigham. Now, there's going to be somebody watching them right over their shoulder, but it will be their first. And whether you'd want to take somebody in a suburban hospital who's done it 500 times and going for 501 versus, you know, that first resident trying it for the first time under, again, don't freak out everybody, under close supervision. We're all watching. Everybody's. But there are firsts, and teaching hospitals, you have people who have to do things for the first time. That's just the way it is. Boy, I'm really sure now everybody's just waiting to get to the hospital.
Yeah, you know, you don't want to be in there on a Sunday in the emergency room either. That's what I've also heard. Or
so the bottom line of this conversation is you never go to the hospital. You might, in fact, practice self-surgery.
Yeah,
make sure you're rested. Take out your own appendix.
Well, let's talk about something that you do have to have done in a hospital. And this is a real, this has got a lot of relevance in Massachusetts. I'll tell you why in a second. But Medicare may no longer exclude sex reassignment surgery because of a Department of Health and Services decision, federal this is. There was an appeal, and the appeal said you may have to do this. It's no longer reasonable to exclude this surgery because it's safe and effective and is not experimental. And even some companies, big ones like Shell Oil and Campbell Soup, are now covering the sex change surgery. And in Massachusetts, I don't know if you know this, but there's been a big stink here for years because there is a this man who's now a woman or on his way to becoming a woman, Michelle Kosolek, who murdered his wife, who's in jail and wants to get a sex reassignment surgery. It's become a big deal around here. Under it's possible that he may be eligible because if Medicare says it's okay, you know, the prison population may be able to get this on the taxpayer dime.
So a couple of points. First of all, sex change operations are not going to break the budget of Medicare or Shell or private industry. So it's not like there are hordes of them getting done out there. What we're really talking about is people being angry that this kind of procedure, elective, maybe they don't support that kind of sexual transition, cross-gender operation. They just don't like it, and they don't want to have to pay for it out of their money. If you do it out of your pocket, great, but not out of the public programs. So a couple things. Medicare, just to be clear, it did approve it and say it's safe and effective, but their standards of safe and effective are, I'm going to say, pretty minimal. If it doesn't kill you right away, Medicare kind of is in the position to say we pay for it. You don't have to say 90% of people who have this surgery are satisfied. And if you go back to the literature, and yes, callers, contact me if you can show me differently, but I don't see a lot of satisfaction, high satisfaction rates with the surgery, and that's what bothers me. We don't have a good gatekeeper. It isn't, to me, just about sex change operations. It's about everything. Medicare pays for minimal demonstrations of safety and efficacy. It doesn't take much evidence to get them to have to say it's covered. And I think the bar is too low. So all kinds of things come through that I don't think are necessarily really effective, really satisfactory to the people who go through it.
But one thing I'm confused about is in addition, the safe and effective declaration by Medicare, are they also declaring that it's safe and effective, and even though it's elective, as you said a minute ago, we'll pay for it? Because the whole the controversy around the Kosolek case that Marjorie mentioned is a very respected federal court district court judge deemed that it was medically necessary in this case. So in the case of Kosolek, and it's being appealed, is Medicare saying it's also medically necessary, or are they saying even when it's elective, since it is safe and effective, we'll pay for it?
What they're saying is, if it is deemed medically necessary by the doctor, will pay for it.
Oh, I see.
So
okay.
You convince someone that you have the identity crisis, you're unhappy. I'm only saying, before we all get caught up in what the heck are we paying for that for, if we got people out there who can't get their vaccines or can't get basic medicines, I'm going to go on record and say, I don't think that operation really does work that well. I wouldn't be confused by what Medicare says in terms of we have to include it if a doctor prescribes it, because I think the literature says people who go through it aren't happy.
Are you talking about men to women or women to men, or does it matter?
Both ways.
Why do you mean not happy, and what do you mean not effective? What does that mean?
They think they're going to be happier as a woman. The procedure, or vice versa, and they're not. The suicide rates are up. The surgery isn't that effective. They feel their appearance isn't quite right. They can't function sexually the way they hoped, that sort of stuff. They're not pleased with the outcomes. And so, to me, the lesson on this one is we need a better check on what do you mean by safe and effective. Sure, people go through it. They're not dead. And effective, yep, everything that they were supposed to operate on, they did. Yeah. But patient satisfaction, if it's really poor, nobody really feels happy at the end of it, or they end their lives because they're not satisfied with the results, to me, that's not effective.
Well, you're not saying, when you said nobody's happy, I mean, there's some...
A lot of people.
Fine.
A lot of people are not satisfied.
Can I ask one last question about this? My concern about the Kosolek thing, other than the fact that he's a wife murderer and the state is paying for this, and actually Deval Patrick, who spends an hour every month with us, decided to appeal this the judge's decision. My major objection was a variation on your theme about vaccines, etc. Most private insurance, even if it is medically necessary, doesn't cover this. Why should the state cover it for a convicted wife murderer? Am I right about that? What's the state of private insurance coverage of sex reassignment surgery in 2014, Art?
So many private insurers will not pay for the reason I said. They're not convinced that the outcomes are good enough to justify paying for it. Some do, some don't. They all have medical boards. They look at the exact same studies in the literature that I'm talking about, and some are going to say, you know, it isn't the fact that somebody wants to change their sex. It's just this surgical thing with the hormones and the drugs, it doesn't work that well in terms of patient satisfaction, so we're not going to pay. Medicare looks at it and says, got some very crude data, looks like people live, looks like the surgery, so to speak, works. They can excrete and do other things afterwards. Okay, it's in. Their bar is way lower than what you'd see a private insurance company use.
Okay. Okay, well, let's move on from this, because I want to talk to you about tanning beds, because summertime is here and little teens will be heading off to these things, unfortunately. The U.S. Food and Drug...
Get your earmuffs on.
Yeah. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration...
I mean, for me.
Oh, good. I'm where you are, I think, but go ahead.
Well, the FDA...
I mean, I'm jumping ahead. Don't even ask me. Ban them. Get rid of them.
Okay.
Are you kidding me? Sun tanning beds? Melanoma? 16-year-olds? Come on!
And they
what an industry!
And they haven't gone that
otherwise,
far.
Otherwise, I have a balanced view on this, yes.
Well, but that is the problem, is you just put your finger on it, Art Kaplan, is that the FDA has required, they announced it last month, these visible warnings stating the devices should not be used on people under 18, but they have not banned them. So they have not, I assume in your estimation, gone nearly far enough.
And is that because of industry power? Why haven't they banned them?
Industry power, industry power, industry power. Lobby is huge. It's a tanning bed in every strip mall in America. You're going to get tons of calls as soon as we're done with me saying sunlight is good for you. It gives you vitamin D. We talked about that before. It's a person's right to decide about their appearance, blah, 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 blah. It's ridiculous. You don't need a tan. Tanning means you burned yourself. And you turn nice and brown like the chicken in the oven. And you get cancer. This is all fashion industry, cultural stuff. There are plenty of cultures around the world that carry umbrellas every day, everywhere, so they don't get tan because they don't like the look of it. This was sold to us by the fashion magazines in the 20s and 30s in Europe, who made tanning and going to the beach something that the rich did, so it became cool to do. Don't do it. There's nothing good about turning yourself into a roasted chicken.
So you're undecided on this issue. And by the way, you know, I saw you on CNN a couple of weeks ago.
I'm waffling around here, yeah.
You could use a little color, let me tell you. Now, by the way, we should know, if people think this is a on the periphery, this same FDA story, 32% of teenage girls admit that they've been in a tanning bed. And since a lot of them know you're not supposed to admit it, my assumption is the number is higher. So somewhere between a third and a half of teenage girls are submitting to this tanning thing. It's scandalous. Do you remember, by the way, one other thing.
Just remember the average tanning bed operator who took his correspondence course somewhere. Is the machinery operating the way it is? Is it safe? Do they know what they're doing? Just asking.
Do you before you go, you know what just popped into my head? Do you remember when the Affordable Care Act it was introduced and everybody was attacking it for every reason? Some legitimate, some not. You know, death panels on the illegitimate end and then others, some legitimate things. Do you remember one of the major complaints from some sector of the population? Wasn't there a 10% tax on going to tanning salons and people went nuts about it?
Yep. Absolutely. Yep.
So maybe 100% tax is the solution.
Okay. So do you walk around with an umbrella, Art, or what do you do?
Basically, I have an assistant do that. I would not.
Okay. Oh, I love that image.
By the way, I'll be looking for that job soon, Art. So stay in touch. Art Kaplan, great to talk to you.
Thank you very much. A lot of passion today from Art Kaplan, who's not a Methodist, whatever I called him before. He is a medical ethicist, head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center, and he also co-edited the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. And keeping to this theme of bloopers, last time I said that Martha Coakley was joining us, and it wasn't Martha Coakley, it was Art Kaplan. Actually, Martha Coakley is here, and she is going to join us up next. She's one of the candidates running for governor. We're going to talk to her at 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
I'm Bob C. Tomorrow on WGBH's Morning Edition, Arts Editor Jared Bowen shares the hidden treasures in a transformed cloakroom at the MFA. That's tomorrow, only on WGBH's Morning Edition.
Saturday, July 12th, it's the WGBH Fun Fest, packed with music, games, and all the ice cream you can eat. A family four-pack is yours for a gift of just $35. Online at wgbh.org/funfest.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Chisholm, Chisholm & Kilpatrick, a law firm with a national practice focused on long-term disability, life insurance, and veterans benefits. You can find Chisholm, Chisholm & Kilpatrick online at cck-law.com. And Northeastern University, where researchers are engineering new construction materials and methods to build 21st century sustainable cities. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We are wrapping up our final round of interviews with Democratic gubernatorial candidates before this weekend's convention. Worcester, joining us today in studio is the Attorney General of the Commonwealth. She would be Martha Coakley. Hello, Attorney General.
Good afternoon.
So, Attorney General Martha Coakley, before we get to the campaign, there is a bit of news today that I want your reaction to, because people don't know this. You were, for many years, a prosecutor in Middlesex County. The district attorney in Middlesex County did a lot of sex offender work, child abuse work. The Supreme Judicial Court in Massachusetts just today ruled that lifetime parole for sex offenders violates the state's constitution and ordered an end to this parole board oversight of offenders who finish their sentences, which basically means they finish their sentences, they're out on their own. And many people think that sex offenders are never cured, if that's the right verb to use. What's your reaction to what the SJC did?
I actually just heard that, Marjorie, coming in. I have not had a chance to read the decision. I just have the top lines on it. At least it seems to me, from the little bit I know, is it's saying you can't take from the judges to the legislature. You can't take something and make it automatic like this, where it belongs to the judges to do. So I think judges can impose, as they do in other instances. But I don't know. I have to look at the decision and see what it actually means, whether it's gone for good or whether the judges have discretion to do it. Look, we struggle with this issue, and I think the court struggles with the issue also, about how do we protect people's rights on the one hand, and how do we protect kids and others from people who are sexual offenders. And this idea of people who are sexual predators is really different. We dealt with it for a long time, of people who abuse children. They're different from bank robbers, frankly. And trying to get this so that it's fair has been very difficult. And we've had a lot of these decisions by the legislature that then get overturned, whether it is around the way we do, you know, the announcing of people who are sex offenders, the way we list them. And I think we're going to continue to see this struggle, particularly with a recent case in the news, to keep people safe, but also to protect people's individual rights.
Okay, well, that was the breaking news for today. Let's get back to the convention, which is coming up this weekend. We had State Treasurer Steve Grossman in here, I think it was yesterday.
It was yesterday.
And you are way ahead of him in the polls. But he has said that if you don't, if you're rejected up in the convention this weekend by the party insiders, the people that know you best, if he gets a big win or you don't get a big win, that you need to do some quote-unquote soul-searching. Do you have to do some soul-searching if things don't go well this weekend,
well,
Attorney General?
Certainly I'm not worried about being rejected. You know, I have always looked at this convention, and this was true, you know, running for Attorney General. I look forward to going to conventions because you need to get your 15% to get on the ballot. The purpose of the convention is to get people excited. Look, we did our caucuses. We get people organized around candidates, around ideas. Get people elected. We still have a lot of uncommitted delegates, and people get elected to go for somebody. They change their mind. They, you know, this is a very fluid process. It's an exciting one, and we're looking forward to Saturday so that we will have our 15%. We will get people excited. We'll talk to delegates. At 15% is a win, and that's what I'm focused on. I'm really, you know, what really counts is what happens on primary day in September.
But isn't there some legitimacy to the notion you are crushing all the Democrats in the polls? These are the people, you know, the rhetoric, who know you best. They're Democratic Party activists. They're people who are most engaged in politics. If the clear frontrunner doesn't leave Saturday as the frontrunner of her fellow Democrats at the convention, that does make some sort of statement, does it not, Martha Coakley?
Jim, you know better than that.
Why not?
Because, first of all, we've got folks, some of the folks going to the convention have gone for the last 20 years. So, yes, they are involved in politics and they are insiders. We have a lot of people who ran, and rightfully so, because they wanted to support Julia Kayyem or they wanted to support Don Berwick. The ways in which people come to go to the convention are very different, and it's different from looking at the general population. And so I think that the convention is a great thing, and it was great. We have five terrific candidates running for governor. Everybody is smart. They're interested. We've all learned from each other in this, by the way, and I think everybody is a much better candidate. The convention is about the rules that aren't going to change at this stage. Have you been able to organize with your ideas and your organization? Have you been able to get 15% both to get people to that convention and to vote for you when they're there?
What's the most important thing you've learned from any of the four of your opponents?
During the course of this, both Julia Kayyem and Don Berwick bring perspectives from their experience, as does Joe Avalon. We have two doctors running for governor.
Yeah.
How cool is that? And so we have all learned, I think, from their perspective, the way they look at issues, the way they talk about them. That's different from the way I have as a lawyer in my life. And I think the discussions we've had, particularly around energy and business and how we are going to be a more prosperous and fair commonwealth, what I'm interested in, I think has been really good. I think it's brought the level of debate up a lot.
Now, speaking of debate, there was a Boston Herald debate yesterday, a fetching picture on the front page of the Herald today with all five of the candidates. Joe Avalon took a selfie of all of you. It came out, that wasn't the selfie that ran, it was another picture, but did you get a chance to take a selfie, or was it just Joe Avalon that did the selfies?
Joe actually took the phone from me saying, "You're good at a lot of things, Martha, but I know how to do this better." And I let him do it. So it was a good picture.
Martha Coakley, you have taken some heat from people on both sides of should the casino law exist in Massachusetts. As Attorney General, you determined that the question as proposed, which would repeal the casino law, violated the Constitution, Article 48, and shouldn't be on the ballot. It's challenged. It's front of the Supreme Judicial Court. I don't want to get into the legal arguments there. I want to get into your position on the question itself. Should it be on the ballot in November? You will not vote for repeal, correct?
I have said I will not vote for repeal.
Are you not concerned? We've talked a lot about this in the last couple of days. $5 billion spent every year, gambled every year on the lottery, more per capita than any state in the country. And we've read a lot recently about the inequity of both the collection and the distribution. On top of that, three casinos plus maybe a Native American casino and a slots parlor. Do you worry about what at least seems to me to be a growing reliance, if not over-reliance, on gambling dollars, mostly coming from lower-income people, to support the things you believe in government? Isn't that troubling to you or no?
Well, of course I worry about that. And it's one of the reasons I took the position I did when the legislature voted to put this in, to say, hey, we need a money laundering statute. We need to put in money for the addiction issues that we know we're going to see. We need to know, we have to mitigate the ways in which this gets handled in the state. And particularly, it's why I'm against internet gaming. I think that that is not a good way to go. It's why I've stood up against the companies that have come in and tried to foreclose on people who've gotten into gaming debts. I mean, there are protections that we can put around what we do. I've said it's not the first place I would go for economic development. That was a decision by the legislature. So my role in trying to say, let's make it as safe as possible, let's mitigate those damages. And interestingly, I think the statute's working the way it's supposed to.
Would you have Deval Patrick championed this, and it surprised a lot of liberal supporters of his. Had you been, let's assume it wasn't the law, and you become governor in January, and there was a proposal out of the legislature to have three casinos and a slots parlor in Massachusetts, would it have your support?
No, because I have said that's not where I would go for economic development. And I appreciate even then that's not where I've gone first. I think now we've got other opportunities for economic development.
But if it turns out, the likelihood is quite good. Even if they award the Western Mass Casino to Springfield, I think the operator there has pretty much said, we're not going to move ahead. And I'm paraphrasing terribly much with this ballot question pending. So maybe we end up with a slots parlor. If you don't think it's the best choice for economic development, and most people think it does change the culture of a state, why would you not say, frankly, I'm going to vote for repeal. I hope people repeal it. And come January, you're going to hear a lot of new economic development plans that are far better for the Commonwealth than gambling is.
Well, first of all, it's one thing to say we're going to have one casino, which Springfield wants. You know, we gave areas an opportunity to make that determination. They've made that determination. We've gone down that road. You do what you can to mitigate it. But I also think the legislature and people overwhelmingly wanted this back then. And the statute gave local control. And the SJC will decide soon. I'm not personally against it being on the ballot. We just made a call, as we always do on these, like a trial court does. And then we knew it would go to the Supreme Judicial Court. I don't know what they're going to decide. I will be happy with whatever they decide. If it goes to the ballot, great. If it doesn't, then the court will have decided that it shouldn't be on a ballot. That's all that is about.
We're talking with Attorney General Martha Coakley, who is running for governor of the Democratic side. We had Steve Grossman, state treasurer, in with us yesterday, and we asked him the same question. So I'll ask you. You know, there's been a lot of problems in recent months with the Patrick administration, the Department of Children and Families, the health connector is still not running the way it was. I think Grossman called the medical marijuana rollout a fiasco. We asked him how he would grade Deval Patrick. How would you grade the 8 years of Deval Patrick's governorship?
Not just on those issues, but
in general, on
overall.
I'm just citing. Overall.
Yeah.
I'm just citing some of the messes.
Look,
the
in
last
8 years, the governor has an enormous amount of responsibility. I think overall, Governor Patrick, in a very tough economy, he came in as I did when we were hoping to promote a healthy economy, and Wall Street had other ideas, you know, crashed it. We lost our pension money. We lost our homes. Our cities and towns have been trying to dig out of the loss of income from real estate taxes. Houses foreclosed, lost their value. So I think that the governor, in moving ahead on investments in education and what he's been able to do in the green communities, has been extraordinary. And I think the state is on the right track. We've got to fix some things, which we'll talk about in a second, I'm sure. But I think overall he gets a very good grade for inspiring confidence, working not always perfectly with the legislature, but no governor does, I will say that. And I think he's left Massachusetts much better off than he found it, and particularly given what's happened with the economy, given Wall Street's gambling with our money.
So what's that? A minus, B plus, B?
A minus.
Okay.
Well, let's talk about the things you just suggested we might talk about in a minute. In the last year, he's had to deal with a crisis at the Department of Children and Families, the rollout of the medical marijuana dispensaries, which has been, I think, rocky to say the
least. I agree with that. I've been critical of that rollout.
So, and what do you think about the whole set of management decisions, for lack of a better expression, or management that Deval Patrick has exhibited over the last year in office?
Well, we do have to put them in perspective with, you know, a big state government, a lot of issues. Let's talk about DCF first. This is not a new issue. I have worked for a long time in child issues and with teams around child abuse since I worked in the child abuse unit. And under every governor, Democrat, Republican, I'd hear commissioners say, we have two problems. We leave kids in and we take them out. And we never funded enough. It's been cut. We in a tough budget time when we don't have enough money to go around after this recession, we're struggling for every dollar. So you've got caseloads that are too big, folks that don't get enough supervision. asking young people particularly to go into a very complicated situation in a family and say, we want you to keep this family together, but, gee, keep the kids safe too. That's an impossible mandate in many instances, and we've seen what happens when you ask people to do impossible things. So I have proposed, and I think this makes sense, you have a division of children and families. Within it, you have a protective division for children when kids are deemed to be or potentially to be at risk of physical, sexual, or serious emotional abuse. You have somebody who follows the kid. You have teams that work on, do they stay in the house? Do they have to come out? And I guarantee you, if we can do that, we'll get better results for kids like a Jeremiah Oliver or other kids that we will pay attention to. Can they be safely at home? When can they be reunited with their families, if at all? And if they can't, how do we keep them safe?
Let's talk about the legislature for a couple of minutes. We talked to Brian McGroy out of the Globe earlier today about the fact that my concern is that virtually none of the public are paying attention to what I consider to be a hugely important trial, the probation department scandal. You prosecuted John O'Brien. Mm-hmm. He was acquitted in that case. Now the feds are prosecuting him. The paper reports this morning, and this is not news, that you made some recommendations, sort of staff people, to the probation department. The defense argument here is, and I'll give the shorthand, is this is business as usual. No laws were broken. People recommend friends. They recommend allies, that sort of thing. Is it business as usual, and is it criminal?
Well, first, that's the jury's decision, Jim, and I feel strongly about that. I mean, this is a case that obviously the federal government, the U.S. Attorney's Office, felt they had enough evidence. They have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this is not business as usual, that this was a crime, and that they have to show the elements of that. Look, I am proud of, I've recommended three young women who wanted to go into law enforcement. They were qualified candidates. I was happy to recommend them. I would always do that. But the question before this jury is, was this something different? And, you know, this is a difficult trial, a complicated trial, because it involves years and all kinds of testimony, some of which the jury has to say, is this credible or not? So I'm going to wait for the jury verdict.
Well, one thing that hasn't been in dispute for, I mean, the jury does have to determine, but there's been very little contradiction here. A woman who has endorsed you, Terry Murray, the Senate president, there's been testimony from a number of people about one recommendation in particular, the son of a judge who was a friend of hers, who was deemed, quote, woefully underqualified by one of the judges on the hiring panel, was a heroin addict, fired 2 years after he was hired for heroin possession, this Lawton character. What was your reaction when you read about that? Is that business as usual? Is that acceptable conduct?
Well, the question has to be asked on the people who hired the person, what the reasoning was, and that's at the crux of this trial. What is the reason that the people who are doing the hiring, if that is all true, and I don't know whether it is or not, assume it's true, what was their reasoning? And that's what this trial is about. Look, we all get asked, and you guys also have been asked, friends of neighbors, you know, can we get an internship at the radio station where you work? Can we go here? You guys say, we've never done that. We've never recommended. Look, I'm not saying that we always should be looking to qualifications, but we work on the relationships that we build. And the idea is that we have now changed it. We have strict laws about how we do it. It should be more transparent. That has all changed since this, which is one good thing to come out of it. And so this is what's before this jury.
But when you hear, I understand the ultimate hiring and the jury has to determine why and did it break the law. When you hear one legislator's advancing the cause of a heroin addict, another legislator is advancing the cause of his 21-year-old girlfriend has no qualification.
I can say unequivocally right now, if someone asked me to get a job for a heroin addict, I would say, I'm sorry, I can't do it. And this is in the probation department. You know what I'm saying? It's not just an internship at a radio station.
Aren't you guys the ones against minimum mandatory sentences? And you think, you know,
some of us are.
Some of you are. Exactly. So let's talk about, you know, how we try and be fair to people and how we try.
Yeah.
I'm not, in this instance, I have no personal knowledge of that circumstance. So I am just saying you guys are assuming that all of those facts are true and that now all of a sudden somebody who maybe had a problem or whatever should never get a recommendation for something. I don't know if that's the case or not. But until you know the facts, until you know what went on here and why somebody was hired, people are still going to try and help people get jobs and do things. There's not anything wrong with that unless there is something wrong with it, and that's what this jury has to decide.
Speaking of wrong with it, you urge the I don't know if you did this as an individual or as the Attorney General. You urge the Securities and Exchange Commission to look into the whole Charlie Baker relationship. He makes a personal donation to a key committee controlled by Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey. Then the pension fund in New Jersey, also arguably controlled by Chris Christie, invests millions of dollars in the parent company of one of the organizations that Charlie Baker is intimately involved in. Do you think he violated the law in his behavior?
What I did say, Jim, was that it. When I asked about it, I said it raises concerns that any organization, whether it's the SEC or the state of New Jersey, the people who oversee that, to me, it raises enough concerns that they should take a look at it.
And end of sentence. So you're not venturing an opinion.
I can't draw those conclusions yet, but it certainly, this is what, it raises red flags. It raises concerns.
We only have a minute left. The question that everybody wants to know, Martha Kolick, is why haven't you campaigned in months? I mean, that is the, why have you decided to sit home in your house with your dogs and your husband? Why do you not campaign?
I've been home in my house eating chocolates.
Yeah.
Actually, my dog ate all my Valentine's Day chocolates, you know.
That's not good for a dog,
you know. We had to bring him to the vet. No, he jumped and ate all my chocolates.
That's not the question everybody wants to know.
What is
the question? Caught in a flap, Martha Kolick. You got caught in a flap. You were parking in tow zones and fire department spaces when you were going to fundraisers. And people get very upset about parking spaces. So I want to know, have you cleaned up your act? Are you still parking in these illegal spots?
I wish you could see the smile on Martha Coakley's face. I don't know how to interpret it. Go ahead, Attorney General.
Look, as the governor does, as attorneys general have, we have state police executive protection. They make those determinations about the placement of the vehicle. Mm-hmm. And all I will say is that you can call it a flap if you want, but the state police made that call, and that's the.
So is the state police guy in the car at the time that you're at the fundraiser, so that he can leave in an emergency?
It was not an emergency lane. It was a parking place for firefighters to
right.
park, and they had gotten permission to park there, no more, no less, and so.
It's not a fire lane.
It was not a fire lane, and
that's where Jim Brady parks.
Called a fire lane forever and ever. But this is where facts make a difference. But the point is that I know this is going to continue. I've had trackers following me since September.
Yeah.
I got two trackers following me all the time. They're welcome to do that. I appreciate it. They show how hard I've been campaigning. To Jim's point, I will show you my schedule. I will put it up against anybody in this race. Nobody has knocked more doors or walked more miles or shake more hands.
Yeah, but
than
Martha
I have Kolick, and will.
Okay, so you're campaigning like crazy. Before we let you go, I'm going to give you a little campaign advice. Do you need a little advice? Sure, Jim. Give me a little advice.
Should I take campaign advice from Jim?
I walk in.
I walk in
during the break to say hello, Martha Coakley, and to her colleagues. What do you say? I'm a voter in Massachusetts. I don't know if you're aware of this. What do you say to me, Martha? I'll tell you what she says. God. You look horrible, Jim. What is that? That's not the way to win votes, Martha Coakley.
I said, because I was listening to your prior segment.
Yes.
I said, have you not been taking your vitamins,
okay,
Jim?
Okay, well, that's exactly
you don't look so good.
Okay, you know, and this is discouraging to him because every day he brings in little Tupperware containers of, like, carrot sticks and asparagus sprouts and so forth to lose all the weight he's lost.
Nothing like a good asparagus sprout. Good luck to you Saturday, Attorney General Martha Coakley.
Thank you
Thanks
very
so
much
for your
we'll
time.
We'll look forward to coming back with your new extra hour. You'll be looking for
Thank
guests.
Thank you so
yeah,
much.
We're very sorry.
That's right. Good to see you, Martha.
That's right. High and low will be looking for a guest. Attorney General Martha Coakley is running for governor on the Democratic ticket. Thanks again, Martha Coakley, for coming in. When we come back, it is our concert roundup. We've got you covered. Jazz, classical, and some funky shows that Edgar B. Hoard III is highlighting. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
How the small world of a conflicted dentist becomes the universal search for truth.
He's at great odds with the city. He's sort of raised both fists at the universe.
The story of Job for our time, Joshua Ferris's To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, our first book club discussion on faith, humor, and our journey to know who we are. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Support for our programs comes from you and the Boston Speaker Series presented by Lesley University, bringing diverse people to Boston. The series returns to Symphony Hall next season with Dan Rather, Madeline Albright, Ken Burns, and others. BostonSpeakerSeries.org. And Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, dedicated to defeating cancer, one person at a time in the clinic, one gene at a time in the laboratory. This special combination of care and research strives to offer patients the best possible outcome. Dana-Farber.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And Marjorie gets to work early this morning. First words out of her mouth. What'd you say?
So I can't wait to do the music thing.
Exactly, the music thing. It is time for the music thing, our concert roundtable. We do it about every 6 weeks. Here with us in the Studio 3 are Rob Hochschild. He's with Berklee College of Music. Hello again, Rob.
Hello.
Brian McCreath is from down the hall. He's a host with 99.5 WCRB and a producer for the Boston Symphony Orchestra radio broadcast. Hello there, Brian.
Hello, Jim. How you doing?
And our buddy and close friend, Edgar B. Herrick III. He, of course, is with WGBH's Curiosity Desk. Hello, Edgar.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Marjorie. Hello, gang.
Hello.
Okay, let's. Where do we usually start, by the way? We try to rotate this thing. Where do we. Edgar, let's put you on the spot to get this going.
Yeah. All right.
Take it away,
Edgar.
Like it.
All right. So I'm going to let everybody here into a little window into my process.
We want that.
You know, I'm not as much of a specialist as the other two guys here. So I try to balance. I think about myself as more of the generalist, and I have to kind of balance the different genres and make sure there's a little something for everybody.
But
one of my picks. One of my picks every time. Is picked for the sole purpose of putting that grin on Jim Browdy's face
yes.
to sort of take him back to whether it was his days traversing the streets of Philadelphia
yes,
or
I
your
did.
Days selling sundries on Cape Cod, whatever it is.
Chubby Checker's coming to town? Is that what's happening?
No, this may be even better than Chubby Checker. There's a couple of guys from Philadelphia who were in a group together, Hall & Oates.
My favorite.
I've heard of them.
You don't even know this, but they are
really?
My absolute
I kind of suspect it.
I love them.
I suspect it. I want to put that grin on your face. So Hall & Oates are coming to the Bank of America Pavilion soon, June 12th, a couple days
from
tonight.
Oh, my goodness. Oh.
Hall & Oates. And, you know, I just think whether you are doing this ironically or whether you're doing it seriously, this is going to be a great show. It's going to be outside. It's going to be a nice night. Hall & Oates, a little bit of blue-eyed soul from Philadelphia. Let's hear a little bit of Hall & Oates, Rich Girl. There's the look that I was going for on Jim's face. I mean, how great is this going to be? Can't you just picture yourself down there by the water in the sun?
They still sound good.
They do. Has anybody seen this show live from Daryl's house?
No, I've seen that YouTube. I've seen
awesome.
Some YouTube stuff, yeah.
This has turned into what started what seemingly as a joke online, you know, has turned into something really, really
it's amazing. Hanging out in his barn, he brings in Sharon Jones or whoever, all these
Grace
amazing
Potter.
Musicians and do amazing live stuff. There.
And for two 90-year-old guys, it's amazing they can still sing.
I think
now,
they're only in their 80s.
They
really?
Look great.
The big question,
and they
will Oates
fabulous.
Still have the mustache? I think that's the question every time. So.
Okay. I think it's gone. Yeah.
Now, Rob.
That's going to be fun.
The bar, as they say, has really been set high to start.
So I picked Jim's favorite act of all time.
It is one of my favorites.
Well, I'm from Philly. I wish I could deliver something from the hometown, too. But we've got something more local here. It's a big show for Berklee, actually. That's also tomorrow, like the Hall & Oates show. It's at Symphony Hall. It's this thing called Berklee Night at the Pops. And it's culmination of this recent trend where a lot of students... who've been coming to Berklee and they're really steeped in classical and serious or symphonic music. They're mixing all that up with rock, pop, and jazz, and Keith Lockhart has really paid a lot of attention to this. There's a lot of faculty members who write or perform in the orchestra. So what's happening tomorrow night is Melissa Etheridge, who also went
Ooh.
To Berklee.
Oh.
Nice. She's going to headline this show at Symphony Hall. It's going to be the first time she's ever played with an orchestra, apparently.
And he mentioned this to us when he was here a couple of weeks ago. He was really excited about this.
Yeah, it's been amazing how into this thing at Berklee he's gotten. He's actually handpicked four students who are going to open and do the first half of this show at Berklee. So you're going to hear students or recent grads, songwriters, perform their tunes arranged for the Pops. It's going to be really cool. One of these is a Minneapolis singer-songwriter named Sarah Walk. So now I know I'm the jazz guy, so I'm going to stretch out a little bit here today. So we're going to get the sophisticated pop of one young Sarah Walk. Her music is really great. She beautiful songs of heartache. She's got this kind of fragile but unadorned voice. So let's listen to an arrangement of her tune Still Frames.
Something about the fall always makes me brokenhearted. Back to where we started, but now those days are gone. Trees crying red and the memories, they're not fading. Can't go back and change them. Now you're so far gone.
That's terrific.
Yeah, it's pretty stuff.
That's terrific. How do you spell her last name?
Walk, just like the thing you do when you're going down the street.
Thank you. I'm keeping careful notes in my date book this time, because what I do is I lose my notes and I forget to look online, so I want to have everything organized.
And it will all be online,
it will
by the way,
all
afterwards,
be online.
So don't
That's
get
right.
nervous if
I
you're driving.
I should point that out, but I just want to have it in my date book. Just, okay, now we just move on to Brian McCreese, because it is summertime. When you think of summertime, yeah. The BSOU course, think of Tanglewood.
Well, you do.
And you got to give people advice on if you know, inside, outside, what you know, do it, I mean, suppose it rains.
Let's start somewhere else, though.
Okay.
Rather than the West.
All right. I'm sorry. I know it is, you arrange these things. So,
no,
but
no,
we'll
no.
Get
we'll
to
get
it.
To it. But okay. We're going to start on the east end of the state. And we're going to head up to Cape Ann, Rockport.
Ooh,
okay.
Nice.
Now, if you've seen this new concert hall in Rockport, it's only a few years old, the Shaolin Liu Performance Center.
No.
It's a small, very beautiful little hall with a back window. Literally, the back of the stage looks out. It's all glass. It looks out on the ocean.
Ah!
So as you're sitting enjoying a concert, and they do classical, they do jazz, they do singer-songwriters, they do lots of things, but there's also the Rockport Chamber Music Festival. That's where this hall really got its start. And so as you're sitting in this hall, you're looking out on the ocean. On June 29th at 5 p.m., so this is that time of day when the light changes through the course of a concert, and it's one of the most beautiful experiences you can have. It doesn't even matter kind of like what the music is going to be, but I'm going to tell you about it anyway. But it's just being in this place, one of the most beautiful places that you can imagine for a concert. Now, on June 29th, it happens to be that the pianist Jeremy Denk, recently minted MacArthur genius, will be performing the Goldberg Variations by Bach. I had to say Bach for Edgar in this segment.
You got to say Bach.
But he's also going to be performing a piece by Charles Ives, and this brings a new definition to the term local, because Charles Ives is a New England composer from the 19th century who made a fortune in the insurance industry. He was an insurance man.
Oh, my God.
He wrote music on the side in the evenings and the weekends, and he was a groundbreaking, visionary composer, not credited in his time at all. And only in the last, literally in the last maybe 20 years, has his music really been embraced seriously as the visionary music that it is by the music world at large. What Jeremy's going to be playing on the 29th is called the Concord Sonata. Charles Ives was very, very attracted to Emerson and the transcendentalists of our own area. So he wrote this thing called the Concord Sonata with a movement dedicated to Emerson, Hawthorne, the Alcotts, and Thoreau. And I want to play for you now. This is Jeremy actually in our studio from a few years ago playing the Alcotts. Let's just listen to a little bit of this. It sounds very conventional. There's nothing very tricky about this. This is basic part writing. This could be a church hymn, right?
Is something going to happen?
It's Charles Ives,
yeah.
So anything can happen.
Huh.
He mashes together things before mashup was a term, right? He throws in different things, but he twists the... What? Ooh. What's that? A church hymn from New England becomes Debussy in Paris.
Yeah.
With this dreamy sort of infusion. Now, we're playing this movement, the Alcotts. It's the tenderest moment in this entire sonata. A lot of the rest of it, which is a very substantial piece of music, is just rambunctious, slap up the side of the head, and like I said, kind of mashing together different things in an amazing way. This is to play the Goldberg Variations by Bach, and this piece on the same program is a very, very rare kind of thing. Jeremy Denk, one of the few pianists that can pull this off, and I think it's going to be a tremendous experience at Rockport.
How does it happen that Charles Ives in the last 20 years gets just kind of rediscovered?
You know, it's a funny thing. It's just, you know, people have to let go of their baggage with classical music. There's probably more baggage with classical music than almost any other kind of... We all have baggage, but you got to just let go of the idea that you've got to be trained by somebody and that you have to follow certain rules and that there are ways that you must specify how your music is played. Charles Ives actually wrote he published a book at the same time he published this sonata because there was so much that he wanted people to know about it. But one of the things he wanted people to know is that the markings in the score are suggestions. And so there's an improvisatory quality to this music in any performance. There's not a single approved way
that Ives thought this music should be played. He was always open, almost like a very early version of John Cage, the willingness to just allow other things to filter in, to allow impulse and to allow capriciousness just to inform his music. And so if Ives heard somebody make something up in his music, in this music especially, he would think, right, you got it. That's what I want. So this thing with Jeremy Denk will be really, really special because of the music. But if you're sitting in Rockport looking out at Sandy Bay at 5 o'clock in the evening
time and, the place,
and you hear
great.
Bach and then you hear Ives, it's a tremendous experience.
So I prefer to go back to Philadelphia myself. Yeah. So are you going to take us there, Edgar? Or
I can't take you to Philadelphia right now. And I got to sit somewhere else because I follow Brian McCreath, who's got, you know, again, it's either, you know, some sort of Peloponnesian war that's captured in song, or like, you know, the beauty of a sunset while an insurance salesman's music is, you know, cascading through the hallway. I'm going to just again say, hey, this person's a pretty good pop artist here. Here we go. So, but no, this is, I'm going to throw a light on a sort of singer-songwriter type called Nikki Lane. She's from Nashville, originally from South Carolina, spent a little bit of time in New York. And then, like a lot of artists in kind of the outsider country music movement, which is very strong, she's in recent years moved to Nashville, where there's a lot of young singer-songwriters, again, really coalescing in a really, really good scene down there in Nashville. And she ends up – she had what's called a pop-up vintage store. You know, she'd kind of go to like markets and stuff and just sort of sell vintage clothes. And she has a chance encounter with Dan Auerbach from the Black Keys, which is a band that has gotten a lot of attention, and they've got a new record out. They're very big among NPR listeners. NPR Music is one of these things that have really jumped on the Black Keys. You hear them in commercials all the time. So he decided to produce her new album. Once they got to talking about music and he listened to a little bit of her music, he said, I want to produce you. So she was a little bit uneasy about it, but they teamed up. He produced her new record, and it is absolutely stellar. She has got a really unique voice. She's a great songwriter. She's got a little bit of an edge to her. She's young. She comes out of a country tradition, but with a little bit of more of like that kind of outlaw country style, like you might think of Merle Haggard or, you know, early Willie Nelson. She's got a little bit of that quality, but she's a woman, which makes it twice as cool. So let's hear a little bit from her new record. The record's called All or Nothing, and this track is called Good Man.
Not on my-
Yep.
Well, they've got that Be My Baby beat behind it. A little bit of Dusty Springfield in there, maybe.
That's right. I love Dusty Springfield, too.
She's good. That's
great
good.
Singer. This whole record, start to finish, is really, really good. And she's playing at Great Scott, which is a really small venue.
When's this?
In Austin. This is June 25th, so you got a couple weeks to get your tickets for this. This is going to be a great show. I think she's going to be incredible in this space. So.
Well, as you say, she's not an insurance salesman, but she is really, she can
but she does
really
sell clothes.
Sing regardless in her case. Oh, my
how
God.
How do you feel right now if you're listening and you're an insurance salesman and all you do is sell insurance? Meanwhile, you hear this other guy changing the future of music.
You're not
writing
visionary
books.
Classical music.
Yeah, visionary
classical.
What are you doing?
Exactly. Right. Okay, Rob Hochschild, round two for you.
All right. We've got a Boston-based pianist who's doing a big show in a few weeks on June 26th. Danilo Perez, who's a Panamanian-born composer and pianist. He's here in town. He's at Berkeley. He runs a Global Jazz Institute. When he first came over to the States, he played with Dizzy Gillespie. And so as like a 20-ish-year-old guy, he was playing these very big gigs and was just a great player. And he, over time, has become a kind of a legend in the jazz world as well. He's Wayne Shorter's piano player, which is kind of like being, you know, the starting pitcher.
So
you
played with Dizzy and Wayne Shorter. And
not bad.
That's a resume.
And he's won Grammys, and he's done all kinds of amazing stuff. So this guy's a great composer, and as an improviser on the piano, we're going to hear the beginning of this tune, so you'll just get a sense of how he sort of touches the piano, which is ranges from really powerful high energy to more of a delicate touch. He also does this thing where he plucks the strings inside of the piano and plays it at the same time. It's like he's got a harp and a piano going at the same time.
So,
but anyway, great composer, influences from hard bop and European classical music, folk music. He's got a new disc out called Panama 500, which actually celebrates the 500th anniversary of Balboa getting to Panama. But we're that's a very programmatic disc, to use a Brian McCreath word.
Yeah. So I gotta up my game here, guys.
Programmatic. Write that down.
Insurance.
So I found it hard to pluck a tune off of that disc. So we're going to go back to a slightly older thing from Danilo Perez. This is a track called Galactic Panama. So it's got this nice Latin groove and just this odd piano chord thing happening, but you can't, like, not react to that.
Yeah, when that rhythm drops in there, like, you're not sure where you're at when the piano starts, right? And then once that rhythm drops in, you're like, okay, now I'm home. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
That is awesome.
That's actually pretty great. It is.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to not move your feet and your head a little bit when you hear stuff like this. He's going to be at the Remus Auditorium at the MFA on the 26th. And it's really worth checking out, Danilo Perez.
Thanks, Rob. Now, speaking of words from Brian McCreath, I wrote this down. Did you use the word improvisatory before? You did. I wasn't going to bring it up. And since is that even a word?
You want to just deconstruct that?
Yes.
It is a word. I know what it means.
I'm going to back him up. That is a word,
Brian. Now we're going
to
engage in deconstructionism?
Okay, Brian McCreath, what's next on your list?
Something very not improvisatory. Let's actually just go to the music and play a little late. Name that tune. Anybody recognize this? You'd have to stay to the very ending credits of a film in order to hear this.
I thought it sounded like it was from a film, but I'm thinking John Williams, but I don't think
it is John Williams.
It is John Williams.
This is from Saving Private Ryan.
Oh. It is?
Huh. Yeah. This is Hymn to the Fallen, which comes at the very, very end of the movie. And this is the Boston Symphony with the Tanglewood Festival Chorus. John Williams is in Boston right now, and tonight he'll be conducting the last performance of Film Night, which is one of the most amazing events any year in Symphony Hall. It happens every year. They do four performances. Tonight is the last one, but it'll still be at Tanglewood, Marjorie.
Great.
In August. There'll be a Film Night at Tanglewood, and I tell you, I've been to now a few of these Film Nights, and the energy is unbelievable in the hall. I mean, John Williams walks on stage at the beginning of a concert, and the crowd erupts. He is so beloved in here and everywhere, really. And so I brought up Saving Private Ryan because that is part of tonight's Film Night concert as a tribute to the anniversary of D-Day. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of other great stuff, too. There will be some music from Raiders of the Lost Ark and some music from, well, yes, Star Wars. And when John Williams and the Boston Pops get together on the stage at Symphony Hall, it is just a tremendous experience.
How old is he?
He is 81 or 82.
That's pretty great.
And Tanglewood is a part of his story, too, right? The place. Like, he's beloved there for a reason.
Well, he's one of those figures that sort of has embedded himself at Tanglewood. Yeah. I mean, there's Bernstein, Copeland, and Williams as sort of the three composers who have really sort of embraced Tanglewood as a place and had it inform their own music. He wrote a piece, actually. What is the name of it? It's about trees, and it's very much inspired by the landscape of Tanglewood itself. He spends a lot of his time there when he's not at work somewhere else, just kind of wandering the grounds and being inspired. So when this comes up at Tanglewood in August, it is one of those nights when you just prepare to be there for hours because the traffic jam getting out of Tanglewood takes hours to get through. But it feels so worth it. It feels so great that you've been in the presence of some of this amazing music that people just seem to connect to in a core way, you know? It's not something that you have to work hard to understand, and yet it's something that affects you very, very deeply. Not even if you haven't seen the film. I mean, there's music that he brings to these Film Night concerts. I've never seen the films, but the music is just so great that and he also honors other composers along the way. There's a little bit of Gershwin, and there's some film sequences that he runs during this concert that are just a joy to watch.
That's so. Brian McCreath. Now this round we have to pick it up, gentlemen. So a quick
rapid
hit
fire.
What's the best thing you've got left on your list, Edgar, Rob, and Brian?
All right, I'm going to Thursday, July 17th, so you got some time for this. But this is something we don't talk a lot, it's a style of music we don't talk a lot about here, which is hip-hop. And this is a group called De La Soul, who back in the late 80s, early 90s were very, very influential in the world of hip hop. Them and bands like A Tribe Called Quest and Diggable Planets. On the heels of bands like Public Enemy, which had a lot of aggression and a lot of politics, they sort of pushed hip-hop into a groovier, jazzier direction. And considering this is 25 years since the release of their record, this is going to be a great show, I think, at the Paradise. And I want to listen to a number from De La Soul called The Magic Number. This is one of my favorite all-time hip-hop tracks ever.
That's a magic number. Yes, it is. It's the magic number. Somewhere in this hip-hop soul community was born three, they stubbed me, and that's a magic number.
What does it all mean?
Difficult preaching is posthumous pleasure. Pleasure in preaching starts in the heart.
This is just so bouncy, so fun.
You know what I just
and
realized? That
music is like
I had totally forgotten until you brought up De La Soul, the leader of the group.
Yeah.
Sold me a whole life policy just a couple of years ago. I had totally forgotten that until you brought
him. He's a musical visionary, too. Oh, my God.
That's pretty great. Okay, Rob Hochschild, moving along. What's best on the... And by the way, their whole list, even that which we don't get to, will be online shortly after the show. What do you got, Rob?
All right. We've got a big name in the world of vocal jazz. Cassandra Wilson is touring right now, marking the 20th anniversary of a record she put out in 93 called Blue Light Till Dawn. And this was really a groundbreaking record for jazz vocalists. Everyone was thinking of her as the next Betty Carter. And she kind of turned that upside down with a record that has Robert Johnson and Van Morrison and Joni Mitchell and all kinds of material that made people wonder who she was and spawned a generation of artists like Norah Jones and Jane Monheit and artists who really kind of try to look at the Great American Songbook and say like, yeah, but no thanks. I'm going to do something different.
Yeah.
And so it's a real event to see her at Scholars next week, June 20th and 21st. Let's listen to Blue Light Till Dawn.
Sounds like getting a little dirty in there.
Yeah, exactly. That slide guitar all over.
The music slows and everybody starts the game.
Nice slow vibe.
And then what's your name?
Oh.
Yeah, she just got that great smoky voice. And I don't think you get to see her that often in town and in a room like Scholars. I'm not sure the last time she came, but it's such a great place to see a show, so worth checking out.
Okay, Brian
McCreary,
you're going to
take us home, Brian.
Yes,
and now for
right.
something completely different. Boston soon will be invaded by people who do this.
No!
The Convention of the American Guild of Organists is coming to Boston. Yes!
Oh, my God, wild time.
Yes!
I wish that the listeners could see your face right now. It's like somebody gave an 8-year-old a lollipop.
When are they coming and
where
will they be?
Are pipe organs great or what?
Yeah.
Well, Boston has amazing pipe organs all over town, and the American Guild of Organists will be in town June 23rd to the 27th. Some public events, what I want to draw attention to is actually on June 21st, it's a family day at Old South Church in Copley Square, where not only this kind of thing's going to happen, but live accompaniment to Laurel or Hardy films, sing-along to Wizard of Oz, what else? A live accompaniment to Fantasia, pipe organ, right? A little hands-on for the little ones to get onto the organ and press those keys and have some fun and make some noise. So Family Day at the American Guild of Organists on June 21st, I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And just beware, there will be organists walking all over town during that one week. It's going to be something to behold.
Okay. Do we have time to squeeze in anything else, or are
we
done?
We don't. But we have a time to thank them.
We do have time to thank them.
You don't have to.
Yeah, no, we will. Really?
You know who they are, right?
I do know who they are.
Okay,
of course,
fine.
Brian McCreary, you just heard him speaking. He's the host of 99.5 WCRB. Inside or outside, Tanglewood, really quickly, please. Inside, outside.
Oh, you got to be there for the Andras Nelson 2 weekends. Yeah. Andras Nelson's the next music director of the Boston Symphony. The energy there will be just through the roof.
Okay.
Good thing there's no roof.
Brian is also the producer of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Rob Hochschild is with the Berklee College of Music, and Edgar B. Hurwitz III, of course, runs the WGBH Curiosity Desk. He sits next to us up the stairs. Okay.
Oh, man. We should go.
Let's go.
We should go. We'll talk after the show.
Yeah, weren't you going to the Bee Gees or something?
Yeah, it's a long, painful story.
Let's
just move on.
The Bee Gees.
From Philly.
Yeah, no, they're not.
Most of them are dead, by the way. So we were going to a
BG. It was
BG,
the BG.
Right.
Oh, we're going to go see the BG.
Okay, fine.
Singular.
What's happening tomorrow, Margaret?
What is happening tomorrow? Gee, I don't know what's happening tomorrow. Oh, I do know. Governor Deval Patrick is going to be here tomorrow. So please tune in for that. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Please tune in tomorrow to hear Governor Deval Patrick. And listen to us again. I am Marjorie Egan. He's Jim Browdy. Our production team is Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan. Dylan Karambalis is doing some interning for us. And Alan Mattis is the engineer today. Thanks.